the catastrophic convergence.
This combination of forces of the legacy of the Cold War, free market economic restructuring, and now the onset of anthropogenic climate change, I call this the catastrophic convergence, because climate change arrives in the global south on a stage preset for crisis by those two other existing problems, and this catastrophic convergence unfolds differently in different places around the planet.
That's Christian Parenti. We talked to him about his book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. And what's the real story of Thanksgiving?
They did not say, let's have a harvest and invite the Indians. What they did is they started gathering all of this food, and then they decided to have some military maneuvers. And so what brought Massasoit is the fact that the Plymouth colonists, who remember had signed a peace treaty with Massasoit, were walking around firing off their guns, wearing their armor, and suddenly doing military maneuvers.
That's Native American storyteller and scholar Marge Bruschak. She tells us what really happened back in 1621. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. A recent report from the World Meteorological Organization shows greenhouse gases hitting record levels, exceeding scientists' worst-case scenarios. Most of us make the connection between greenhouse gases and the extreme weather the planet's been having, from record droughts to record floods. 84% of Americans now believe that climate change is real and human activity is causing it. But probably far fewer of us make the connection between climate change and some of the other big problems we face. My guest Christian Parenti says our endless wars, the spread of failed states, and the explosive growth of the drug trade have some of their roots in climate change. In his latest book, Tropic of Chaos, Parenti says a catastrophic convergence between climate change, the flood of cheap guns left over from the Cold War, and free market fundamentalism are driving perpetual global conflict. Much of this is happening in the global south, but it's also leading to a mentality of the armed lifeboat, Parenti says, that's eroding our freedoms here at home. Christian Parenti writes for The Nation and has written for Fortune, The New York Times, The Washington Post, and Mother Jones, among other publications. Christian Parenti, welcome to Writer's Voice. The Tropic of Chaos. First, tell our listeners, what is the Tropic of Chaos?
The Tropic of Chaos is the belt of states around the mid-latitudes of the planet, that most of which lie between the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn. And it is also the region in which climate change is already expressing itself as political and religious and criminal violence increasingly. And the book is an explanation of how this crisis of climate-driven violence works.
You start your book with a really searing story of the murder of a tribal herdsman. Tell us that story.
The book opens with a story of Ekeru Lorimon, who was a Turkana pastoralist in northwest Kenya, and he had been killed the evening before in a cattle raid. And I use his death to unpack how climate violence works, and I try and understand the multiple levels of causality behind his death. So at one level, he was just killed in a cattle raid. Cattle raids are a traditional part of culture in the pastoralist corridor that stretches through Uganda, Kenya, Somalia, Ethiopia, Sudan. But in recent years, the cattle raiding has become much more violent. Part of the answer to why that is because the region is suffering one of the worst droughts it's seen in 60 years. And in northwest Kenya, all of the greenery that the animals would survive on is dead, except for on a narrow band along the rivers or around wells. And so the cattle economy, the pastoralist culture of the Turkana, is in profound crisis. So there's a climatological element. But then the other aspects that feed the violence are the legacy of the Cold War, which has throughout the global south basically littered the terrain with cheap weapons, men trained in violence, ripped up and battered economies, and traumatized populations. And in northwest Kenya, there are lots and lots of cheap guns. They flow out of Somalia, which is a failed state that was produced by one of the hot proxy wars that was a subset of the Cold War, a war between Ethiopia and Somalia, with the Soviet Union and Cuba supporting Ethiopia, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan supporting Somalia. That war ended in the collapse of Somalia. There hasn't been a functioning government there since, and Somalia hemorrhages guns out into the region. So there's cheap guns for people like Ekru Lorman to buy, and for the people who killed him, some Pokot raiders from the Karasuk Hills, they too have access to these guns. And then the third factor in it is neoliberal economic restructuring, or radical free market economic orthodoxy, which has been pushed on one state after another in the global south by the IMF and the World Bank in response to the debt crisis that many countries have faced beginning in the late 1970s. The IMF and World Bank have forced a kind of economic restructuring that requires that in exchange for survival loans, governments reduce their participation in the economy. So in real concrete terms, that means in Kenya that the state doesn't provide as much assistance to pastoralists as it used to. So in the face of this drought, people like Ekru Lorman and people like the Pokot raiders who killed him, they can't turn to the state for veterinary services, for subsidized replenishment of their herds, or for, you know, government-subsidized work programs where they can get cash to survive. So they try and survive by turning to the gun. That's the one tool they have that's readily available, and they try to adapt to the extreme climate by stealing their neighbor's cattle or by driving their neighbors away from the few sources of water there are, seizing by force control of a water hole and guarding it, or seizing by force and policing and guarding with violence the banks of a river where you can farm a little and where you can keep your herds alive and water them. And so the traditional violence of raiding has become much, much more serious. There's higher casualties. There's massacres. I mean, we just had these reports coming out of South Sudan of a major massacre of up to possibly 600 people from a cattle raid. When there isn't cattle to raid, these raiding parties, they'll go out for weeks at a time raiding, and they'll raid buses and civilian traffic as well. And then the Kenyan army responds, or the Kenyan paramilitary police with helicopters and a counterinsurgency. The Ugandan army has crossed the border into Kenya. The Ugandan army has even bombed pastoralists from the air. And, you know, the situation is very critical. There is essentially a state of war in a lot of northern Kenya and other parts of the pastoralist corridor. But it's not a war with two distinct sides to which there can ever be some sort of resolution or end. It's a society disintegrating into violence. And this combination of forces of the legacy of the Cold War, free market economic restructuring, and now the onset of anthropogenic climate change, I call this the catastrophic convergence, because climate change arrives in the global south on a stage preset for crisis by those two other existing problems. And this catastrophic convergence unfolds differently in different places around the planet.
Well, it's just what strikes me about what you're talking about is that the global south, where this has really been happening for a while and is so intense and the greatest impacts are being felt, that there's blowback. I mean, you make a point that the global north and the global south are connected, and we're beginning to see these neoliberal policies bringing down economies here and in Europe. And we're also seeing the whole influx of climate refugees. Could you talk a little bit about how this convergence is now drawing the entire world into its net?
My argument about the catastrophic convergence, or just the way that climate change drives violence, in the global south, it pushes states towards civil war, towards state failure. It fuels banditry, it fuels zealotry and general disorganization. In the global north, it's fueling increased surveillance, increased border militarization, the rise of a kind of climatologically driven authoritarianism. I mean, it's not only climate change, but just that there's an increasingly a small element of causality behind border militarization, increased policing and surveillance of civilian populations in the global north. And also the Pentagon is, and other Western militaries are planning to engage, address this problem through a program of open-ended counterinsurgency and counterterrorism on a global scale. And that's in their documents where they address climate change. And they take the climate science very seriously, and they see a future of civil war and state failure that they're going to have to respond to. So, but the first stages of this crisis in the global north express themselves not as disintegration, state, a weakening of the state, but a hardening of the state. So you see that on the border in Arizona, where the government passes AB 1070, this law that basically strips Arizona citizens of their Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable search and seizure in the name of stopping and deporting immigrants. And a lot of the xenophobic right in the Southwest is increasingly articulating its anti-immigrant agenda in terms of an environmental crisis. You know, people are acutely aware of the fact that these Sunbelt cities, many of them, do not have enough water, that there are not enough resources. And so this is leading to a kind of a mentality of the armed lifeboat. And there are, you know, for example, FAIR, the Federation of American Immigration Reform, which is the main anti-immigrant lobby in the United States, has set up a group called Progressives for Immigration Reform, which young climate activists have protested and called out as a front group that is essentially trying to appeal to Greens and environmentalists to get them on board with a racist anti-immigrant agenda, which is fundamentally about hardening the regime of surveillance and policing and incarceration domestically in the United States.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Our guest is Christian Parenti, and we're talking about what he calls the catastrophic convergence between climate change, violence, and predatory capitalism that's destroying many societies in the global south and affecting us as well. As you say, immigration, terrorism, counterinsurgency become this kind of toxic brew. Could you also talk about what is driving immigration from Mexico, or was? Because actually now with these draconian laws and the decrease in economic opportunity here, that's lessened a bit, but maybe not for always.
Yeah, and another thing that's caused a decrease in immigration from Mexico is the economic slump here, and also the rising demand for agricultural products from China. I mean, you know, China is basically the buyer of first and last resort for much of the global south. So there was that article in the New York Times based on Douglas Massey's research about immigration, and they used the example of agave and tequila, and Asia is the market which is now, you know, buying this tequila and driving up prices. So it's actually helping to stabilize the rural economy in some parts of Mexico. But to the extent that people, which they do in massive numbers, still migrate north, I try to unpack how much of it is climate-driven and sort of think about how you define a climate refugee. There are some climate refugees who are very clearly driven out of their homes by floods or hurricanes. But they're, more often than not, climate is merely one factor among others that drive people off the land. So in Juarez, I met some Tarahumara Indians who had left the Sierra Madre because, in part, drought had made farming impossible for them. And you know, it was a combination of economic policies and these climatological conditions forced them into Juarez. Another guy I met on the south bank of the Rio Grande was this fisherman who had been driven away from the coast of Michoacán, where he was a fisherman, by an El Nino event in the late 90s that caused a toxic algae bloom, drove away the fish. He had one season that was just a total loss. And he couldn't turn to the state for assistance because neoliberal economic restructuring, radical free market economics, have really transformed the Mexican economy and the role of the Mexican state within it. So all of the old semi-socialist supports that the Mexican state once provided for fishermen and farmers have been rolled back. So he had to take out private loans to tied him over. He couldn't pay them back. He lost his boat and his gear, and he went from being a small proprietor to just a wage laborer. He eventually moved north to the U.S. He gets a job as a roofer. Then he gets deported. And when I met him, he was in Juarez trying to figure out how he was going to come up with the money to get a coyote to take him across the border. And he was saying, you know, one of the only ways to make money around here is to get involved in the drug trade, and I don't want to do that. So you can see, is he an economic refugee? Yes. Is he a climate refugee? Yes, in part. And then he finds himself in a position where he could very easily become fodder in this drug war. He could become, you know, the human material of the narco-driven chaos in northern Mexico, which is really, I mean, it's not a drug war. That almost gives it a sense of coherence that it doesn't have. Like, there are two sides fighting each other. There are multiple sides, and law and order has completely broken down in Juarez. I think in 2009, I believe two murders were prosecuted in Juarez. So that means, you know, if you want your neighbor assassinated, you can hire some teenager to do it for $100, and the chances are very, very slim that you will be caught or prosecuted for it. Mm-hmm. So the violence there is way beyond people fighting over drug turf.
Mentioning the drug war, there was an article in the New York Times about the Brazilian Northeast, which you also look at in your book, Christian Parenti, the book Tropic of Chaos. The article was about how the drug war is taking over the northeast of Brazil, and there was no mention of the climate crisis that is affecting the Northeast. You went there, you talked to people there, you also found some very positive solutions. I wonder if you could talk about what's happening in the Brazilian Northeast and what are some positive ways that people are dealing with it.
In the Northeast of Brazil, I found a community of farmers who, you know, I mean, it was almost just like made to order. It was this parable for what adaptation involves. So they lived in the semi-arid northeast in a valley with a road that went through the middle of the valley. On one side of the road, there was a small village, and the people there owned their land, and they were using a form of mixed tree and vine crop organic agriculture that they called agroecological forestry, or the system. And it was involved low-tech kind of irrigation. For example, you know, using a single plastic water bottle with a tiny hole in the cap upside down, strapped to the side of a small fruit tree so that it would drip down and just irrigate that tree. Techniques of water harvesting, like building an underground dam, essentially a wall that's buried underground that hits bedrock that acts much like a regular dam would by keeping moisture in the soil above it. So it's a way of capturing moisture in the soil. All sorts of really ingenious techniques that produce this valuable organic produce for which they get a premium. But the problem with this is that it takes several years to get this system up and running. On the other side of the road was a cattle ranch that was owned by an Italian who was not in the area. And this community needed more land to survive, so they had organized with the Movimento Sem Terra, the MST, the Landless People's Movement in Brazil, which has very famously had great success over the last 20 years and redistributed land to tens of thousands of Brazilians. And with the guidance of the MST, this community organized. I mean, the MST doesn't have people there. They became the MST. The community became the MST. And they took part of this cattle ranch, and they were occupying it. And I hung out with them for a few days. And it only came out like right before I left that I realized, wait a minute, on the side of the road they were occupying, they were using the kind of traditional modern version of farming, monocropping, clearing away the trees rather than planting around them, exposing the soil to erosion and the wind and the sun, and using pesticides and artificial fertilizers, which has the beyond the environmental damage, has the risks of driving them into debt. And I was like, why are you doing this, you know, method of farming over here that you spent 2 days criticizing, essentially? And they're like, well, you know, and they were kind of like embarrassed by it. They were like, look, you know, we can't actually, until we get title to this land, I mean, we could get thrown out of here any day by the police. They could come in and crack our heads open. until we get title to this land, we can't afford to invest the time necessary to restore it and, nurture it for 4 to 5 years before we make any money. We have to make some money now in case we lose the land tomorrow. So we're planting these monocrops in, with chemicals and the kind of modern fashion. And so to my mind, that really showed how social justice, the redistribution of land, the protection of, the redistribution of wealth to poor people, particularly in the global south, the redistribution of land from big landowners to small landowners is a prerequisite for a technological change that is about restoring humanity's relationship to the soil. That you cannot expect there to be some kind of environmental balance if there isn't also social justice, that the two are inseparable.
You mentioned before that the Pentagon is planning for climate change. It takes it very seriously, calls it a threat multiplier. Tell us a little bit more in depth with the ways in which the Pentagon is preparing for climate change.
Well, it has conducted numerous studies, some of which are secret, some of which are public and readily available on the internet, and which look at the security implications of climate change. Climate change is now a factor in the Quadrennial Defense Review, which is the kind of strategy document that the armed services present to Congress every year to explain sort of what the mission and means of the American military are, what the threats are. And so it's incorporated into the planning and thinking about that. And what the Pentagon sees is not so much, and the Pentagon uses it as the basis for these calculations and scenarios, the science that is vetted and published by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which does not do research itself, but it is the main UN body that collects, vets science about climate change. It's not just climate science. It's also biology and, marine sciences of all sorts, anything that relates to climate change. And government and industry gets to weigh in on the IPCC's process, and they publish this information for policymakers around the world to try and think about climate change. And so the Pentagon uses that. And I say that because it's important to remember this, because so many in the political class in this country reject climate science and reject the IPCC and portray it as if it is radical and out there, but the armed services don't.
And they may even go beyond the projections of the IPCC, because those projections are fairly conservative.
Those are very fairly conservative projections, though they are continually revised, and they become increasingly alarming with each quadrennial report they put out. But what the Pentagon sees is less an increase in conflict between states of resources and more likely an increase in internal conflict, civil wars around religion, ethnicity, possibly class-driven civil wars, and increased banditry, increased state failure, increased humanitarian crises. And they realize they'll be called upon to intervene in these conflicts and crises. And so that means not conventional warfare, but low-intensity conflict, irregular warfare, counterinsurgency. And so the program that is developing, and it's usually not described as a response to climate change, it's described as the war on terror, or it's described as peacekeeping, or whatever it is. But an element in all these crises is increasingly climate change. So what it is, they have this image of an open-ended, worldwide counter-terror, counter-insurgency campaign that never ends, that uses special forces, it uses advisors, it uses limited interventions. And, it's the war on terror writ large. Look at Yemen, okay? The CIA and the Pentagon have increased their participation in the war in Yemen. Why is there a war in Yemen? Why is there a war in Libya? Why is there essentially a war in Syria, except one side doesn't even have very many guns and does all the dying? In part, the Arab Spring, which is a very unfinished process, it involves many positive things, people's movements, the overthrow of kleptocratic dictators, but it has also led to these three wars. That was caused in large part by a surge in grain prices between June 2010 and June 2011. The price of wheat went up 83%. The price of corn went up, I think, 91%. This was linked to bad weather in Australia, bad weather in Canada and the U.S., flooding in Canada and the U.S., and the worst drought in 100 years in the Black Sea region, around which sits Ukraine, Russia, and Kazakhstan, always in the top grain exporters. Russia is always in the top four or five grain exporters. So in response to the Black Sea drought, Glencore, which is one of the largest commodity traders in the world, which is actually run by Mark Rich, who's a fugitive from U.S. law. It's based in Switzerland. And along with Cargill, it is the second largest commodity trading company in the world. So Glencore publicly urges Russia to ban grain exports in response to the Black Sea drought. Russia does that. Grain exports surge. Glencore has a fabulously profitable initial stock offering, an IPO of $360 billion. I think they make a $60 billion profit off of it. And so wheat prices surge. Russia cancels contracts to Egypt. Egypt is the single largest wheat importer in the world. Food inflation in Egypt during the year of the rebellion last year was running at 20%. If you look at the early reports from the protests, the cost of living was always central in people's demands. In Tunisia, the last thing President Ben Ali did before he fled was promise to lower prices. So I'm not saying that the rebellions in Tunisia and Egypt and Libya and these other places are all about climate change or even all about food, but I'm saying that the price of food was an important contributing factor as to why the other grievances came to a head now. Why this year rather than last year or not some other year? Part of it was because the tremendous spike in the price of basic grains, which is linked to climate change. So then in Yemen, that creates a civil war. There's Al-Qaeda-connected militias in charge of cities in Yemen. There, you know, Yemen is teetering on the brink of being a failed state. And so the Pentagon responds to what? They respond to chaos and Islamic terrorism. But what's underneath that? One of the driving causes is climate change.
Christian Parenti. We're talking about his book, Tropic of Chaos. Stay tuned for more after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with journalist Christian Parenti about his latest book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. It's a brilliant exploration of how three forces, climate change, free market fundamentalism, and the spread of lethal weapons, are coming together to create conflict in the global south. Just before the break, Parenti was telling us how the U.S. is responding to this by preparing for and engaging in perpetual counterinsurgency. I imagine that a lot of people might be hearing this and saying, well, you know, given this scenario, phew, I'm so glad that the Pentagon is, you know, thinking about climate change and responding with this counterinsurgency to keep us safe. Is this response going to keep us safe?
In the short run, the response, a militarized response, looks robust, but it just breeds more instability. If you look at what counterinsurgency does, because the object of counterinsurgency is the civilian population, I mean, in conventional warfare, the idea is you take territory from your opposing army. In counterinsurgency, the state forces already control the territory. What they don't control are the people. They don't control the beliefs of the people who are supporting the guerrillas, be they communists or Maoists or ethnic nationalists or religious fanatics, whatever it is, the dynamic is the same. And so the methodology necessarily attacks civilian society in a way that creates what sociologists call anomie, normlessness. It smashes to pieces the social solidarities that connects societies because of methods like torture, forced relocation, forced participation in auxiliary militias. counterinsurgency is the anthropology. Warfare is anthropology, and it tries to get into the belief systems and social solidarities of people who are in rebellion and remake them. And what it ends up doing is rending old forms of solidarity and not replacing them, and leaving societies traumatized and atomized, and therefore more prone to violence. So you see that in Central America, in Honduras, Nicaragua, Guatemala, El Salvador. Many of those countries in the last 15 years have had murder rates that are as high as were the death tolls during the civil wars of the late 70s and 1980s. But it's not warfare. There are no guerrillas opposing the state in El Salvador, for example. What there are young, traumatized, unemployed kids who are now part of the Central American offshoots of California-inspired street gangs that use the hand-me-down hardware of warfare, like hand grenades, to battle it out with each other, to hijack buses and rob from people. It's a society in total trauma, but it has a casualty rate that would make it look like it's a war. So that's the direct result of counterinsurgency. Counterinsurgency is what ripped those societies to pieces. So I think counterinsurgency and counterterrorism as well is, very, very dangerous at a kind of sociological, anthropological level. To just contrast it further with conventional warfare, they did studies in World War II about what the effect of strategic bombing was. It was the exact opposite of what counterinsurgency was. When London was bombed by the Nazis, there was increased social solidarity. Out of the experience of the Blitz comes British social democracy, as we know it during the Golden Era, a leveling of class differences. Food is rationed during the Blitz, and that, people think of that as hardship and scarcity. Well, it was for many people, but, many people in London before the ration didn't have any milk for their kids. And then suddenly during the war, everybody was in it together. Everybody got a little bit. They were all in the subways, on the tube, hiding from the Nazis. There was tremendous social solidarity created by that. I'm not advocating conventional warfare, but just to think about these methods differently, that's really, really different than counterinsurgent forces going into a village and assassinating a few people, turning people into spies, getting one set of cousins to become the civilian, the civil patrol, as they did in Guatemala, to police the others. Those are intensely destructive methods. And when the war's over and the cause has disappeared or been won and the military withdraws, the damage done by counterinsurgency does not go away.
Then we come back to the kind of example that you gave before. And, I think of Bolivia as well, the counter to this kind of counterinsurgency that is so destructive, how to knit societies back together. Would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, social solidarity can be rebuilt, and political movements do that. They count on social solidarity as a basis for organizing, and then they help build social solidarity. And you see that in Bolivia. Bolivia is... You look at Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia. Now, he comes out of the Chapare region, which are the low-lying jungle regions of eastern Bolivia. And miners, Aymara Indian miners who worked in the tin and silver mines in the highlands, were driven out of there as those mines closed. They went into the Chapare to grow cocoa. At one level, they were deracinated, and their solidarity was ripped up by this move. But they rebuilt this solidarity by creating the Cocoleros Unions, which are kind of de facto, they're a social movement and kind of a de facto government out in the jungle, because these were, to some extent, outlaw communities that were under attack. And they organized, they demanded the right to grow coca and to sell it and survive. And that's what Evo Morales comes out of. And Bolivia's social movements, even in other regions, embody this kind of using old community level solidarity as a basis to organize, and then through these social organizations, building and deepening solidarity, and then eventually through an election, taking state power and trying to use the resources of the country, partially renationalizing gas, to create development, create a participatory democratic process that helps nurture and build solidarity. Things don't just move in one way. It's not just that societies disintegrate and become more violent. They can also build new forms of solidarity and shore up old forms of solidarity. And you see that in Bolivia. And Bolivia is a perfect example of kind of like something, an idea that's very modern and comes out of the Enlightenment, socialism, being wedded with this very traditionalist indigenous worldview about how people are part of the earth and you know, taking care of and being part of Pachamama. And it's, you know, the new and the old complementing each other and reinforcing each other.
Finally, Christian Parente, you know, we here have seen the tremendous effects of climate change, a mega drought in the Southwest, you know, hurricanes hammering the East Coast, tornadoes in the Midwest. You focused on the Global South, but as you did this book and completed it and look back and you've been talking about it, what lessons do you think we need to apply from your book to what's going on right here in the U.S.?
One key thing is we really need to think about the unintended consequences of military aid, military strategy, the blowback aspect that you mentioned earlier. So we really need to rethink the war on terror and all of that kind of the entire program of U.S. military intervention around the globe. But I think the primary responsibility in the U.S. is to deal with mitigation. In the Global South, in many ways, the most pressing thing is adaptation, because the actual emissions in most countries in the Global South of CO2 and other greenhouse gases are pretty minimal. And the main crisis is how are people to adapt to the amount of climate change that we're locked in for or is already happening. Adaptation is potentially much easier in a wealthy, technologically advanced culture. But we have a special responsibility to deal with mitigation, which is to say reducing greenhouse gas emissions because we emit so much of them, and we have the capital and the technology to potentially help lead the world in making that shift. So I come up with, at the end, a few very practical things that can happen right now that don't require getting the Republicans in Congress to go along with passing new climate legislation or allocating any new money. So the EPA, due to citizens' action lawsuits beginning in the late 1990s, by 2007, it was ruled by the Supreme Court that the EPA has the responsibility to regulate greenhouse gas emissions under the Clean Air Act. We are waiting still for about 30 rules to be issued by the EPA to implement that law. If those rules were issued in a robust fashion, it would essentially impose a de facto carbon tax on the EPA. This is, you wonder why the right wing hates the EPA. It's because the EPA is potentially a very, very powerful agency in transforming the nature of the U.S. economy. So if there was a de facto carbon tax, that would help shift private investment towards solar, wind, hydropower, tidal kinetics. And that's decent economic policy. Tax the things you don't like burning filthy coal and oil, and support with subsidies things you do like windmills and solar power. So that's something the EPA could do right now. It has the power. It has the obligation to do it. The other thing that could be done without any new money or new legislation is the government has tremendous purchasing power. The federal and state governments in the United States constitute about 38% of our GDP. If the federal government were very serious about using its procurement power to buy clean energy, buy electric vehicles, and retrofit its buildings, that would have a tremendous effect directly, because it would help reduce the carbon footprint of the government sector, especially if the states followed suit. But indirectly, it would also have a very positive effect, because it would create markets for clean energy, electric vehicles, the batteries, etc., building retrofitting services. And in creating markets for the clean tech sector, it would help jumpstart the burgeoning clean tech sector, which right now is suffering badly for lack of markets. We've just seen three solar panel companies go into bankruptcy because they don't have markets. And the federal government has the largest fleet of buildings in the economy, is the largest single power consumer in the economy, and has the largest vehicle fleet, buildings and vehicles. It is going to spend money on fuel for its vehicles. It is going to replace vehicles and buy vehicles, and it is going to buy electricity for its buildings. And so it's not about getting more money. It's going to do this. Why not use that money to reduce carbon emissions and help jumpstart the clean tech sector? It's something that can happen today, and it doesn't require Eric Cantor or John Bonner or Rick Perry to suddenly believe in science. It can happen now.
And it would create jobs.
It would create a lot of jobs. Of course, who would suffer in all this? Not business in general, even, but a specific sector of business, the oil and coal industry and the refining industries associated with them, which have billions of dollars of sunk capital that they are trying to defend. So the Koch brothers' pipelines are threatened with becoming scrap metal if we move away from oil and coal. So that's why they invest so much money in Americans for Prosperity. That's why they have gone to war against the EPA, because they're directly threatened. But actually, the fact of the matter is, there are many sectors of the business community that would stand to make profits and would find profitable outlets for investment if we made this transition away from fossil fuels to clean technology. And hopefully, if labor were at the table and participating vigorously, that transition would be done with good union jobs that pay a living wage.
Well, Christian Parenti, you really put all this together in a powerfully written book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change, and the New Geography of Violence. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
In addition to Tropic of Chaos, Christian Parenti is the author of Lockdown America, The Soft Cage, and The Freedom. He won the 2009 Lang Taylor Prize and Best Magazine Writing 2008 from the Society for Professional Journalists. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to articles by Parenti, including one called Reading the World in a Loaf of Bread, Soaring Food Prices, Wild Weather, Upheaval, and a Planetful of Trouble. Next up, the real story of Thanksgiving. Well, it's Thanksgiving time again, a time when Native American storyteller Marge Bruchak gets a lot of requests to talk about the first Thanksgiving, when the English settlers got together with the Wampanoag natives of Massachusetts for a feast. The year was 1621. Bruchak co-authored the book 1621, A New Look at Thanksgiving. We talked to her in 2005 and thought it was a good idea to bring it to you again today. I started out by asking Marge Bruchak what really happened way back then.
It was not a Thanksgiving. Thanksgivings to the Puritans were specific religious ceremonies. They often involved a day of prayer. They often involved a great deal of fasting. And feasts were an entirely different kind of activity. The feast was more like a harvest home feast, more sort of a carryover of old English harvest traditions. Thanksgivings for Native people were held on each of the 13 full moons of the year. So it just so happened that this coming together of Plymouth colonists and Wampanoag people happened near a full moon in the autumn and at a time of great hardship for the Plymouth colony. Because here's the thing, people often imagine that it was many, many Puritan pilgrims and a handful of Native people. But in fact, there were more than 90 Native people present. They were the vast majority. Of the colonists themselves, there were only 52 out of the original 103 English colonists still alive. Most of them had perished during the winter.
And how long had the colonists been here?
They had been there since the November of the previous winter. And so there were only 4 adult women. There were only 16 adult males. And in addition, there were 9 seamen and servants who worked on the ship but were not considered members of the colony per se, and there were 23 children. So sometimes you see these 19th century illustrations of the feast as though all of these English women are feeding these poor starving Indians, when in fact there are over 90 of Massasoit's people, and then their women and children.
Who is Massasoit?
Massasoit was one of the key sachems of the Wampanoag people. He was a leader commonly known as a chief. His name, in fact, means great chief. His given name was Osemequin. So Massasoit is a title more than anything. He was from the Poconoka people, who are in present-day eastern Rhode Island. And his decision to form an alliance with the English was very strategic at that moment in time. At that moment, the Wampanoag were engaged in conflict with the Narragansett in present-day Rhode Island. And the Wampanoag thought it might behoove them to have good trading relations with a small English colony that they could carefully control. I think they had no idea that so many colonists would come. They understood that this small colony were religious separatists, they were iconoclasts. I think they thought this was a manageable group. And they also didn't understand the degree to which the colonists intended to take over Wampanoag territory. So, for instance, any so-called unimproved or wild or untilled land was considered the property of Christians, despite the fact that Native people had been living on it for millennia.
And considered by the pilgrims.
By the pilgrims.
Right.
I want to step forward into this timeline of how Thanksgiving morphs into an American holiday, because one thing that few people understand is the fact that most of the colonial Thanksgiving days were actually celebrations for victories over the Indians. So the first regional Thanksgiving celebrated in New England was actually in 1637 after the Pequot War. There were small individual days of Thanksgiving within Massachusetts Bay Colony and Plymouth Colony, but the victory over the Pequots, literally the massacre at the Mashantucket Pequot Fort, was declared a region-wide Thanksgiving. Massachusetts Bay Colony set aside October 12th as a special day of Thanksgiving for subduing the Pequots, and there was a similar Thanksgiving day established after King Philip's War, when Metacom, Massasoit's son, was killed after that rebellion. His head was put on a pole, put in the middle of Plymouth Colony, and the day of his death was declared a day of Thanksgiving. So it makes me shudder sometimes to think that we rarely talk about that aspect of Thanksgiving. And even the way Thanksgiving became a national holiday owes much to the Civil War, when Abraham Lincoln declared that we should have a day for celebrating the blessings of field and the fruits of the field, and it should be a national holiday. And that ties in with a woman named Sarah Josepha Hale, who thought we needed a day to celebrate the founding fathers and celebrate families coming together to feast. So, in a way, all of these American Thanksgivings over time have very little to do with celebrating Native presence on this landscape and have a great deal to do with claiming the landscape as English or as American territory devoid of Indians.
Well, that's a pretty tragic foundation to this holiday. And yet there was a kind of congress, I'd say, between the two peoples. When you're talking, I guess, before King Philip's War, before these massacres, there was a kind of connection. There was a feast at which the Indians and the pilgrims came together. What's this about?
As I say, it's very strategic. To kind of back up for a moment, Squanto is often held up as a hero. And there are many children's books, and there are moments in curricula across the country where people teach about Squanto helping the pilgrims. Squanto is seen to many Wampanoag people as a traitor. He was also seen in his own time as a direct traitor to Massasoit. Massasoit's strategy was to negotiate a very careful peace with this one colony in order to facilitate trade, in order to have allies in any potential conflict with other groups. Squanto tried to manipulate that for his own ends. A man named Hobomok, who lived very close to the Plymouth colony, was actually sent there to keep an eye on them, to watch over them. So the thing that's important to remember is that it was a strategic peace, it was a delicate peace, and it was never as stable as it should have been or could have been, in part because there wasn't balance on both sides. I'll give you a great example. There's a moment in the Plymouth Colony records when Massasoit has gathered together a number of sachems to confirm this peace, and the terms of the agreement are reiterated over 20 times. Each sachem has to speak for his community and recaps the entire summary of what's just been said. And in the Plymouth Colony records, the pilgrims are saying, what is it with these people? Is it not good enough to say it once? But what you're seeing is a model of Native consensus. You're seeing the fact that every one of those Wampanoag communities has to assent that no one community can take another's fate into its hands. And even Massasoit, as a central chief, is responsible to all of those people. Whereas the English style of government is so dramatically different. What we call representative democracy means that one person is chosen to speak for everyone else. And they can often go off on their own and make decisions that might harm the entire community. So when you look at the leaders of the Plymouth Colony, and when you look at the leaders of the Wampanoag communities, they're negotiating in dramatically different ways. And the Plymouth colonists are after one thing more than anything else, and that's land. They intend to expand. They intend to stay. They do not intend to allow Wampanoag people to hold on to their sovereignty.
Right. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're speaking with Marge Bruschak, author of 1621, A New Look at Thanksgiving.
the entire myth of this event as the so-called First Thanksgiving, as this foundational moment in American history, is based on Edward Winslow's account of a 1621 autumn harvest feast, when he writes, "We set the last spring some 20 acres of Indian corn and sowed some 6 acres of barley and peas, and according to the manner of the Indians, we manured our ground with herrings, or rather shads, which we have in great abundance, and take with great ease at our doors. Our corn did prove well, and God be praised, we had a good increase of Indian corn, and our barley indifferent good, but our peas not worth the gathering." And he goes on to note that that was the first successful harvest they had had. And being that it was a good harvest, it was time to gather together and celebrate the harvest.
So why did they choose to invite the Indians, or did they choose
to
invite
the Indians? Well, they didn't. That's the important. That's a very important detail people often miss. They did not say, let's have a harvest and invite the Indians. What they did is they started gathering all of this food, and then they decided to have some military maneuvers. And so what brought Massasoit is the fact that the Plymouth colonists, who, remember, had signed a peace treaty with Massasoit, were walking around firing off their guns, wearing their armor, and suddenly doing military maneuvers. So when Massasoit showed up with 90 men to investigate what's going on, you can tell from the records that he was suspicious. It's only after he arrives and realizes that it's a feast they're preparing for that he sends his men out, and they hunt 4 deer and bring them back. And so the largest quantity of food is not even this harvest that the colonists have brought in using native technology, using native styles of fertilizing and everything else to prepare the food.
You mean with the fish.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's not the bulk of the food. The bulk of the food is the deer and the corn and the native food that Massasoit and his people bring.
Now, I have a question.
Yeah.
You've shown us how the myth differs from the reality. Well, you've shown us how the reality differs from the myth. And yet that myth is there. It's a very powerful one. What do you think that's about? Have you done any thinking about why was this myth necessary? Why was it necessary for white Americans to create a myth of friendship with the peoples that they had conquered?
The important point to make is not there was friendship. There was a negotiated friendship. The myth implies that Native people had already vanished by that moment in time, and that the few Indians who were left were invited to a feast that the English hosted. So I think the nature of the myth gives the English a sense of dominance over the landscape and over the history at a moment in time when they were, in fact, struggling and starving and about to disappear themselves.
There's something about that one big happy family.
Right, that's the mythical part, that one big happy multicultural family, that forgets the fact that this is native landscape. It forgets the fact that the Plymouth colony is very, very small. And the entire continent of North America, the entire continent of South America, is all Indian country. Even though there have been plagues, even though there has been contact, it's all Indian country. And so what often happens is that tiny little Plymouth colony hanging on for dear life on the coast is made to look much larger than it is in fact and is given so much more power than it has at that moment in time. And that power just extends across the continent with manifest destiny. And I think that's the danger of the myth. If it were a truer rendition of the story, you would start from the Wampanoag perspective of a long inhabited landscape, more than 12,000 years, and considering how you deal with this small band of strangers who enter into your landscape. And you would learn from the Wampanoag point of view that negotiation, reaching out, helping strangers is part of their way. And even little details like the first person to encounter the colonists is not Massasoit, it's Samoset, who is an Abenaki sachem. He's from north in what's now Maine. And he's traveled down to this territory, and he sees these people, and he knows who these people are. They've been taking captives from the coast for several decades now. There are more than 80 Native people stolen from Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, Wampanoag territory, all up and down the coast have already been taken back to England as captives. None of these Native people are in awe at the arrival of the pilgrims, but they make a decision, and the decision they make on the spot is a negotiated peace. And I think that's what's lost in that myth of the happy family.
One of the reasons the English colonists survived is that the Wampanoag showed them how to grow corn. Marge Bruchak is a member of the Abenaki tribe. She told us her people's story of how they were given corn.
The story that we have in Abenaki territory talks about corn as a young woman who comes in the middle of winter during a starving time. And when she comes to the people, she's very tall and very lean. She has a long green dress that rustles when she walks. And she asks for a place to stay through the winter. And the people take her in, and they give her room in a lodge, and she sleeps with four grandmothers. And she spends the whole winter with the people. And through that winter, she can't speak their language, but she learns a few words. She listens to the story. She watches how the old care for the young and how the young care for the old. And when spring comes, she gathers those people together. And she says to them that she is grateful for the way they have cared for her, even though she is a stranger. She is grateful for the way they have treated her like a sister. And she has a gift to give to them. And she tells them to give them this gift, she will have to die. And the people say, oh, no, sister, you don't have to die. We have good medicine people. We can cure you. And she says, no, no. When I die, you will take my body and you will lay it in your fields. You will pile the earth over it and you will watch that place and my gift will come to you. And so with heavy hearts, the people do as they have been asked to do, and they take that woman's body and they lay it in the fields and they pile the earth over it and they watch and they wait. And when spring comes on, a small green plant grows out of that place, and it is just the color of that woman's green dress. And it keeps growing. And as that plant gets a little taller, it has leaves that come out and they rustle the way that woman's dress used to rustle when she walked. And the plant keeps growing. And when it gets to be as tall as that woman was tall, it grows seed pods on the side. And from each of those seed pods is hanging long strands of sandy brown hair, like that woman's hair. And when they peel open the seed pods, there's the gift. And this is the food she gives to them. And so the people right away, they give thanks, Bemkikta, Kikta, Olioni, to the earth and sky for helping that plant to grow. They give thanks to that woman for coming to them. They give thanks to all of the grandmothers for looking after that woman like she was their own kin. And there's a song that goes along with that. It's called the Green Corn Song. And it's usually sung in four parts, thanking the four grandmothers that looked after that woman, and it kind of goes like this. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Yanigawes, yanigawes, yahanigawes. Olalike kwe wanneo. Olalike kwe wanneo. Olalike kwe wanneo.
Marge Bruchak is an anthropologist, historian, and museum consultant. She's also a performer of Algonquian Indian music and oral traditions. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.